Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, a weekly program exploring Hawaii Island's issues, problems, and solutions. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning, everyone. Welcome to Island Issues. Before we get into Island Issues, I'm sure you're all paying attention to this, but Tropical Storm Flossie continues to head our way. So after you listen to Island Issues, please take a look at your emergency supplies. Make sure you have everything you need in case you have to shelter in place. And if you think you might need to evacuate, start thinking about what you're going to do and where you're going to go. And be sure to make special provision for pets. We'll be issuing civil defense alerts and updates throughout the day and into tomorrow and into Tuesday. At this point, they think we may be seeing heavy rain, heavy wind, possible flooding starting Monday morning. Now, for Island Issues this morning, this is the third and final talk story about brain trauma with Dr. Mark Ashley. He established and runs some brain trauma rehab centers in California and Texas, and his Center for Neuroskills is where Dr. Teresa Wang went after being severely injured with brain trauma as a result of a terrible car crash in November of 2010. She spent more than a year, actually, in total rehab and 2 years getting sort of back to normal, and she's doing really quite well. And we learn more about that in the last two interviews. And you may hear those interviews online, bigislandnewscenter.com, down on the right for online listening or downloading. Today, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, Dr. Ashley talking about health insurance coverage and what kind of treatment is available here in the state if we need that kind of treatment here. Is it possible for a brain trauma injury patient such as Dr. Wang or any other person to get the kind of brain trauma rehab they might need in the state of Hawaii? Is there a facility in our state that exists to do what your centers here in California and Texas do?
Well, let me start at the broader level. The treatment that's available in Hawaii, i.e. Queens Medical Center, is state-of-the-art. I've seen the work that the staff there does. It's nothing short of phenomenal. They do tremendous work. One of the challenges, however, is the state's geography. So the timing that it takes for a patient to get to trauma care for these catastrophic injuries contributes to the complications of their condition. We do have an acute rehabilitation hospital in Honolulu, and that's Rehabilitation Hospital of the Pacific. They do fine work as well. In Dr. Wang's case, looking at her medical diagnosis, there were some 28 major medical diagnostic categories to describe her condition. You mentioned 28 fractures. They're not the 28 I'm talking about. This woman was very, very severely injured. Now, insofar as Center for Neuroskills kind of treatment is concerned, no, that kind of treatment is not available in the islands. And the reason for it is largely economic. At this juncture, an individual with a traumatic brain injury faces real challenges in getting access to treatment. And it's not like a heart attack. It's not like cancer. When a person has an appendectomy, a tonsillectomy, or cancer, or a heart attack, what needs to be done for that patient is very circumscribed. Everybody knows what it is. It's readily available. For brain injury, there's not been the same kind of recognition. Because no two brain injuries are alike, because this is a heterogeneous diagnosis, talking about brain injury as a condition is the same as talking about cancer as a condition. And we know that doesn't work. There are many, many different kinds of cancers requiring many different kinds of treatment. So brain injury has been relegated to back rooms. We have countless individuals living with unnecessary disability in their family homes, left out of the workforce, or living on the streets, depending upon the individual, or incarcerated, or living in nursing homes, because they were not afforded the opportunity to get rehabilitative services. So if you have an HMO, you are not going to get access to this level of treatment. The HMO will not pay for it. If you have accident and health insurance that is of the PPO variety, depending upon the nature of the advocacy that you have on your behalf, you might be able to get this kind of treatment. This is one of the Brain Injury Association of America's primary concerns, is access to treatment. When you have a catastrophic injury to the brain, you're not able to advocate for yourself. You've lost your physical abilities, your communicative abilities, your cognitive abilities, your intellectual skills, in other words. you're not able to participate in an informed consent fashion, which is fundamental to the delivery of medical treatment. You therefore have other people undertaking this on your behalf. If your insurance fails to provide you with access to this level of treatment, what are you to do? You're probably not even aware that it's necessary, much less that it's being denied. And so, the vast majority of individuals with moderate to severe brain injury do not receive adequate treatment for their condition. Dr. Wang's instance was different, not because of her medical insurance, but because of the advocacy of her legal representative.
Well, that brings us to the specific. She says that HMSA, which was her insurance provider, would not cover this, and she was fortunate enough to be able to change insurance companies. The two major insurers in our state are HMSA and Kaiser. Speak to what HMSA and Kaiser each would do relative to helping their patients recover from brain trauma, to your knowledge.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have a great deal of knowledge on this. With reference to HMSA, the company's official position on cognitive rehabilitation is that they will not cover cognitive rehabilitation. They consider it to be experimental treatment and therefore not a covered benefit. Mind you, Blue Cross Blue Shield Technical Evaluation Center, which provides advisories to all of the Blue Cross Blue Shield companies, long ago issued an advisory that said cognitive rehabilitation should be covered. Additionally, the Brain Injury Association of America for some time has recognized this, yet HMSA has not kept pace with those changes. Unfortunately, what both of these companies are failing to recognize is the huge difference between a catastrophic brain injury and other medical conditions. And a catastrophic condition is not well managed under a managed care product, nor under many PPO products, if in fact they don't understand the nature of the condition. So in Dr. Wang's case, there is actually a desire to move her backwards in the continuum of care from our level of care back to an acute level of care, and that was in large measure to stop the cost of her treatment and to reduce the cost and gain control of it. And our conversations with that carrier were such that in my career I had never seen a patient go from our level of care to an acute level of care unless there was a marked change in the patient's medical condition, which was not the case in Dr. Wang's situation. Insofar as Kaiser is concerned, Kaiser's model is to provide the care within the confines of their system, and it works well for common medical conditions. But when you get into the complex conditions associated with traumatic brain injury and all of the specialists that need to be available to these cases, much less the highly specialized knowledge in treating brain injury and reprogramming these cells, it doesn't exist within their system. We work with Kaiser cases occasionally, and we're always happy to do so, but it's a tough model because these cases can be very, very expensive to treat.
Roughly how many patients have you in your brain rehab centers treated over the years?
I think we're somewhere north of 3,000 patients or so.
Is brain trauma rehab something that ever ends, or does it go on forever?
Does brain trauma rehab end? Sure. No, absolutely.
So you have people who graduate?
Yeah, no, a large number of people graduate, of course. And there are those occasional patients for whom we can only take them so far. We don't know how to take them further. And that's either our knowledge limitation or the kind of damage that they have to the brain that we just are unable to make additional change for. But in an ideal world, an individual's rehabilitation in large measure should be taken care of within the first 12 or so months of treatment. There are some people who will need a little bit longer. Many people need much less time. If we get to them early after injury, and there's not been any delays in their access of treatment. Immediately following a brain injury, there's an increase in production of what's referred to as trophic factor expression. Think of it as fertilizer for your lawn. The brain knows that it's got to repair itself, and so these substances are produced. For a period of time, after that period of time, this upregulation diminishes. We need to work in that time frame. And while we're working in that time frame with rehabilitative efforts, we actually promote the continued production of these substances. So timing is crucial. Setting is also crucial. I can't do in an acute rehabilitation hospital setting what I can do in a setting like ours. I can't teach you to cook, and I can't have you cooking 7 days a week, 3 times a day. I don't have 21 opportunities in a week to do that teaching. And I can't let you learn from your mistakes. If you think about what is required to cook, you've got to be able to stand by the stove or sit by the stove. You've got to be able to think about preparing all of the ingredients, monitoring the temperatures for what's being cooked. You have to multitask. You have to do lots and lots of things. And if you don't do some of them well, you burn your meal or you undercook your meal. And when you eat the burned meal, you recognize very quickly it doesn't taste as good. You now have a real-world natural consequence that induces better learning. So we can teach skills, and that's just one example. Additionally, these things require so much time. Our patients will receive up to 17 hours of therapy a day, 7 days a week. In an acute hospital setting, they'll receive 3 to 4 hours of therapy a day, 5 to 6 days a week. And so as the patient improves, we see that the patient's medical acuity diminishes and their ability to benefit from intensified therapy increases. And so that's when we increase those efforts. I guess in summary, the point is the treatment works. The reasons people don't get treatment are largely financial. And we don't see that happening necessarily to other sorts of major medical conditions. We have to ask ourselves whether or not this financial stinting on care is appropriate. We know that when we don't treat, we prolong high levels of disability and we cost the individual and society tremendous sums of money. When we do treat early and the treatment is effective and it's done in highly specialized settings, we reduce the cost of care manyfold and we reduce the disability. So it's the right answer for the patient and their family, it's the right answer for society, and it's the right answer for the financial party who's on the hook long term. If the financial party's not on the hook long term, of course their incentive is going to be away from treatment, not toward it.
If I were paying for your treatment myself, give me a sense as to what it costs.
It's exceptionally expensive. You can be looking at anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 a day, sometimes even higher, and this can go on for months. So you can be looking at anywhere from $100,000 to well over $300,000 to maybe even as much as $500,000. There are some cases that are even more than that.
Dr. Ashley, you mentioned research. Are there other kinds of research going on that will ultimately benefit the rehab for brain trauma?
Yeah, the first thing I would say is that spending on research for brain injury is fairly low. The National Institutes of Health spend about $81 million. That's simply not adequate funding. We need to get better funding for research into brain injury and mitigating the effects. This is an exciting time because we're just coming to understand the interplay between an injury to the brain and the role and impact both on the autonomic nervous system, the endocrine system, and the immune system. So we're able to look at the chronic medical conditions of persons who have had brain injuries and begin to think about medical interventions that will mitigate the progression of disease processes that are initiated at the time of a brain injury. You're hearing a great deal in the popular press about chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This is the condition that NFL players and others suffer from associated with repetitive concussions. What we're now beginning to understand is that a blow to the head, even without a concussion, can be such that alteration of endocrine function or immune system function can be sufficient so as to either initiate or accelerate the development of other neurodegenerative conditions. And those conditions are conditions like multiple sclerosis, Huntington's chorea, Niemann-Pick, Alzheimer's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and others. So many of the conditions, like Parkinson's disease, that we're accustomed to thinking about as coming on in a de novo fashion. De novo meaning brand new to the patient, no other known etiology. Some of these conditions may have etiologies and injuries to the brain that went unrecognized earlier in life and predisposed the brain to some of these degenerative processes. My prediction for you is that in the coming decade, we're going to have much clearer elucidation on both matters. One, what those conditions are that are in fact accelerated by brain injuries, and two, what might we do for those individuals who've had injuries to prevent the acceleration or even the progression of those neurodegenerative conditions.
What have I not asked that you'd like to share with our listeners?
We talked a little bit about access to treatment, and unfortunately, we named only two companies. Imagine that if you had an expensive condition like a cardiac condition or like cancer, if your policy said, gee, you only get 30 days of treatment, or no, I'm sorry, but the treatment that you need that's delivered in this other setting, you can't have because we don't pay for that other setting. We know that's the treatment you need, but we don't pay for it in that setting, and you can't get it in any other setting. So the rehabilitation benefits that are in most policies were designed for musculoskeletal or orthopedic conditions, not neurologic rehabilitation, because neurologically injured patients didn't live 30 or 40 years ago. Today they do, and today we need to interpret those benefits very, very differently. I think that the general public is under the misimpression that if they have a catastrophic injury, that their health insurance surely will provide protection. Insurance is intended to provide a financial protection for low probability of occurrence, high cost events. Instead, our health insurance has evolved to covering the high probability of occurrence, low cost events. And unfortunately, companies like HMSA and Kaiser and many, many others recognize that that's what the problem is. They're spending so much money there that when it comes time to spend money on catastrophic conditions, it's difficult to find it.
Is the benefit situation any different if a patient is covered by Medicare versus being a younger person like Dr. Wang?
Unfortunately, Medicare and Medicaid don't recognize acquired brain injuries treatment requirements well. And so in this age of cost containment, the message that we would bring and have brought that is about the need to better recognize brain injury in Medicare and Medicaid populations and treat them more in tune with the standard of care that's developed falls on deaf ears. So the only age group in which we see an increase in the number of traumatic brain injuries is in the elderly. We used to miss these cases because if an elderly person showed in an emergency room and they were confused or disoriented, it was often assumed that that was because of their age-related dementias. What we're finding is that there's much better sophistication now in the emergency medical management of these patients, and we're seeing that a number of patients have traumatic brain injuries as a result of falls or spontaneous bleeds that would be an acquired brain injury. And as a result, the numbers are growing dramatically. In addition, we have many more people entering those age groups than we had before. If you have a stroke in the U.S., you're going to get about 2 weeks of treatment, of rehabilitation. You're going to get a little bit of outpatient therapy, and then you're going to be done. Yet, we know that if we provide much more treatment, we get much more recovery of function.
A reminder, you're listening to Island Issues. I'm your host, Sherry Bracken. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Ashley. We interviewed him at his office at the Center for Neuroskills in Encino, California. That's in Los Angeles area. He runs brain trauma rehab centers, and we've been talking about that this week and last week. When I was with Dr. Ashley in California, I asked him to expound a little more on brain trauma, brain injuries as a result of being hit in the head, concussions, playing football and being hit in the head, playing soccer and being hit in the head. He mentioned there are a couple of articles that he likes on the subject.
One speaks to the notion that one can unleash these degenerative forces within the brain without a concussion, just with a blow to the head. The second speaks to what can happen to these degenerative conditions, or insofar as they're concerned, from a single concussion. And so the idea that's out there that one gets dinged, if you will, is really an inappropriate concept. We really can't protect the head enough. You can't travel in a bubble. But there's no more important organ in the body, and there's no more vulnerable organ in the body from what we're learning. And then finally, there's no more difficult to treat organ in the body. So when you have that combination, you really have to be very, very careful. There's a study that was done that looked at the metabolic recovery after a single concussion in a number of football players. What they demonstrated was that the return of the brain to its normal metabolic state after a single concussion didn't occur for 30 days. If you take a look at our return to play guidelines, there's nothing in there about 30 days. Now, this was a single study, and it does need to be replicated. And this was a study of college-level football players, and so this was unlikely to have been their first concussion. But they reported that it was. There was a small group of individuals who sustained a second concussion before the 30-day window had transpired, and it took those individuals 45 days for their brains to return to a metabolic baseline. Now, the metabolic baseline is how the brain processes oxygen and glucose, converts it to energy, and all those biochemical or bioelectric exchanges that occur in the brain in order to get it to function. It is the most basic level that we can talk about in the brain. And it's that level that induces the immune system or the endocrine system to function properly or poorly and to initiate or to arrest disease processes. So if we're playing with that system with a blow to the head and we're looking at a very gross mechanism for returning an individual to play that is, can you remember 5 words 3 minutes after I give them to you? Or can you repeat some numbers after me? Or can you run 50 yards and come back and not have a headache and not be dizzy? If those are our criteria for returning you to play, you might return to play in a day or two or three or four, but your brain's metabolism is struggling. We're going to continue to stress it just when the wires, if you will, are frayed enough that more stress will cause them to die. We're doing all the wrong things. So if it's my child, they're not going back to play for at least 30 days, if they're going back to play at all. And we really have to ask ourselves whether we can make these entertainment events safer and nonetheless enjoyable. So we've come a long way, and my suggestion is that we could go a little further. A sport like boxing. Why do we have a sport where the intention is to render the opponent unconscious, is to cause a brain injury? Can it involve other parts of the body and be as entertaining?
And at this point, we're going to go to a separate conversation with Dr. Ashley. After the last 2 weeks, several people asked me some additional questions about the topics. So 2 days ago, I reached Dr. Ashley. He was on vacation in New York, and we got a few additional questions answered about insurance and about stroke. Now to Dr. Ashley. Dr. Ashley, aloha. Thank you so much for taking time out of your New York vacation to talk with us.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. Several things came up in our recent conversations about which people have asked questions. And the first question is, you mentioned different insurance types, HMO and PPO. What are they? Does HMSA one and Kaiser the other? Just a little bit more about that, because you mentioned that neither one has terrific coverage.
Yes. Well, PPO is a preferred provider organization, and it's your typical health insurance product. It's product that enables an individual to go to a wide variety of providers, a wide variety of facilities. The HMO is a contained market product, and organizations like Kaiser, for example, have all of the facilities, all of the providers as part of their organization, and the individual is restricted predominantly to use of those resources in pursuit of health care. Now, clearly, an organization can't have all health care available, and so an organization like Kaiser would, in fact, contract with care providers that it doesn't have in-house.
Dr. Ashley, is there really any kind of health insurance that provides what is necessary for brain trauma rehab as you would define it?
Actually, I don't think there is, and it's unfortunate. While the health care reform is intended to remove lifetime limits, within the policies, carriers can still impose limits on health care. So what we have is a very poor understanding of rehabilitation across the board in these health plans. And it's understandable in that rehabilitation was first designed predominantly for musculoskeletal or orthopedic kinds of injuries. Severe neurologic injuries were not survived typically, so when neurologic rehabilitation developed as a result of better trauma care and survival of individuals, these policies needed to change. So in many instances now, the same benefits that are available for musculoskeletal or orthopedic rehabilitation, that rehabilitation of a muscle or a joint injury, are the only benefits available for an injury to the brain or the spinal cord. And those benefits have time limitations to them or number of visit limitations, and therein lies the trouble.
And I do want to interject. Last Wednesday, I sent an email to both Laura Lott with Kaiser, she's the Kaiser spokesperson, and to Alisa Yadow, the spokesperson for HMSA. And my question was, can I get a statement from you on what your company's philosophy is regarding brain trauma rehab? Laura Lott from Kaiser wrote back and said, "Hi, Sherry. I'm sorry to have to take a pass on this. I'm on deadline on two other projects and heading out of town tonight. Please think of us another time." Alisa Yadow with HMSA said, "At HMSA, our members' health is very important to us. We do recognize cognitive rehabilitation, which is often performed by speech therapists, as an appropriate treatment for brain trauma rehabilitation. And we provide coverage for that rehabilitation when it's provided by a qualified licensed professional, such as a physician, licensed psychologist, speech therapist, or occupational therapist. However, each case is very different." And they really couldn't comment on the specifics of Dr. Teresa Wang's case. So we did get an answer from each of the providers, and this is something that you should probably talk with your own provider about if you have questions. Dr. Ashley, when we first started our conversation, it was really because of Dr. Teresa Wang, who received brain trauma as a result of being violently hit in the head, but you've also spoken of stroke as needing brain trauma rehab, and that's what led to a lot of questions from folks who heard last week's interview. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about stroke, starting with what exactly is a stroke?
Well, strokes come in two forms predominantly. One is an embolic or thrombolytic stroke. This is where blood clots form in the vascular system and move to areas of the vascular system that they cannot pass, and they occlude the vasculature. So the downline structures don't receive oxygenated blood, and they suffer damage as a result. The other type of a stroke is a hemorrhagic stroke, and this is where a blood vessel ruptures, and the blood flows from the blood vessel into the surrounding tissues. And the consequent problem is that the downstream structures, again, don't receive oxygenated blood and are damaged.
How is stroke related to heart disease? Because especially the first kind you mentioned sounds a little bit like the description of a heart attack.
Well, yes. If a thrombus or an emboli ends up within the vasculature for supplying the heart, then, of course, the structures of the heart will be starved of oxygen and will be damaged. And so there is that connection. But really, what we think about predominantly in terms of heart disease is that when we have certain valve disorders or rhythmic disorders in the heart, these disorders can cause the formation of clots to be released by the heart, and those clots can go to the lungs or to the brain. Secondarily, if we have an individual who has hypertension, another form of cardiovascular disease, then the person's blood pressure can be too high, and that can result in these hemorrhagic strokes.
So if the factors that cause heart attacks are similar to the factors that cause strokes, why would one have a stroke versus having a heart attack?
It depends where the embolus or where the hemorrhage occurs. If the embolus or the hemorrhage occurs within the brain, then we end up with a stroke.
Okay, now if somebody has a stroke, tell us what the impacts might be.
Well, the range of problems after a stroke can go from virtually no long-term effects to death. The most common sort of problem that we see, however, is a stroke in the left hemisphere of the brain, and we see these strokes involving the areas of the brain that control speech or motor functions for the right arm or the right leg or the right face. that tends to be the most common type of presentation. Less common would be a similar presentation on the right side of the brain, which would affect the left side of the body, but would not typically affect speech and language function.
Based on what you've seen in your experience, to what degree and how often can patients recover enough from stroke to resume the activities of normal daily living?
Well, most individuals recover the ability to take care of their dressing and grooming and hygiene. The difficulty that we have is, of course, that's not all there is to life. And so when we have benefit restrictions that only bring a person back to the ability to dress themselves, groom themselves, use the toilet, and perhaps feed themselves, we really leave them terribly short of the skills that they would desire to have. So recovery is quite possible after stroke. Unfortunately, we don't tend to get patients the kind of treatment and the quantity of treatment they need to maximally benefit.
I know that you obviously run brain trauma rehab centers, but talk about typically how people do recover from stroke. Can it be done with just inpatient therapies such as at your kind of facility? Are there outpatient therapies? Or is it acute care hospitals, or can it be done at home? Talk a little bit more about that, please.
Well, there are options for treatment in each of those settings that you mentioned. And typically speaking, rehabilitation begins in an inpatient setting and will progress to either a day treatment or intensive outpatient setting, or an outpatient setting that is less intense. Sometimes the therapies can be done in the home by therapists who visit. But one of the challenges that we have is that we have yet to deduce an appropriate regimen. So we don't have good research that tells us what the appropriate dosing of rehabilitation should be. We do have research that tells us that essentially more treatment is better than less treatment, and I think that's important to understand, but we don't have research that tells us that an hour of physical therapy or speech therapy a week is effective. And unfortunately, when we look at some of the policy restrictions will enumerate the number of sessions that a person can receive, and these can be somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 24, sometimes 30 visits in a year. So this means that the patient would be restricted across that year to one, two, possibly three visits in a month for therapy. We don't know at this juncture that one therapy session a week or two therapy sessions a month will in fact bring about an optimal amount of change for a person's recovery. In fact, we have strong reason to believe that it's an insufficient dosing.
Sounds like education is really one of the keys here. Are there any other sources you can suggest for people to learn more about stroke and brain damage and brain rehab?
Yes, the Brain Injury Association of America and the Stroke Association will provide good information about those conditions and treatments and resources that are available.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Ashley. I so appreciate your taking time out of your vacation. Aloha.
Aloha.
And to our listeners, thank you for being with us. This is Island Issues. I'm your host, Sherry Bracken. I'll see you next Sunday for another Island Issues, and you may hear this and the most recent... And you may hear this and the most recent past Island Issues online, BigIslandNewsCenter.com, down on the right. Until next week, please, let's all drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for joining us for Island Issues. We welcome your suggestions and input. Email us at info@islandissues.com. Join us next week at the same time for another edition of Island Issues. Island Issues is a public affairs presentation of Mahalo Broadcasting.